Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 4, which I think is where we're up to. Well, we're not actually up to Module 4 yet, but Lecture 4, if you like. Announcements. 1. The remote bundle is broken. What am I going to do about it? Eventually replace the USB to serial boxes with PCI serial cards, which should make the whole thing a lot more stable, because it turns out that it's the serial ports that don't come up most of the time, and then you can't get at things. So, yes, we know about the fact that Workstation 1 Pod 2 is down, and I'm not happy about it either. Now, the problem is you can turn things on and off, and sometimes that fixes it. I have now set a password on port 2. This will be going into the documentation at some point. The password for the remote power manager... to get into the remote power manager port, you basically go in and you type in power at the initial connect prompt, and that will give you access to port 2, which will allow you to turn all sorts of things on and off. Don't turn things on and off too quickly, or you will corrupt file systems on the virtual Linux boxes. Yes, I can fix them, but I've actually got to pull the particular machine in question out of the rack, like wiring wise, and plug it into the wall and then mess with it that way. So, fun in a box.
And Kerry, what about the what about the issue of and the bundle, I couldn't connect from one workstation to another, like even on the ones where both were working, I couldn't ping workstation 2 from workstation 1 even when I set IPs on them.
Okay, basically you've got to run MII tool and see whether the actual MII-tool and find out whether the thing thinks it has link, and then if it doesn't have link, you do a shutdown-r now, and that will reboot the virtual Linux box, and it will suddenly decide that it has link. Basically, there's a problem where the Cisco switches take forever to boot up, and if the switch isn't booted by the time the virtual machines come up, it doesn't see link on the virtual machines, and you don't actually ping the other virtual machines. So that's the solution for that one. That's an easy one.
Okay, MII tool? I'm not familiar with that one.
MII-tool. It does a media independent, MII is media independent interface, and it dumps the status registers of the Ethernet card so you can find out whether it actually has, link beat and stuff.
Cool.
Somebody else have another question?
Yeah, actually two now, but Jason inspired me for a more relevant one. I had the same problem as him when I emailed you. So if I had rebooted both workstations on pod 2 or 3, in theory that probably should have had them able to see each other?
Maybe. It's highly likely. I wouldn't say definitely, because the difference between a used car salesman and an IT salesman is the used car salesman knows when he's lying. But it should have helped.
Very nice. Now, what I was going to ask before that's a little less relevant, but I'd like to ask anyway just so that I can learn something, is why is it that we connect to the remote bundle via Telnet instead of SSH when I read all of this information about why I should use SSH for everything and not Telnet?
Because the black box serial switch that we have, which is horrendously expensive, I can't remember how much they were, they're around a couple of thousand, I think, only supports Telnet, and that's why.
I see. Whereas if a corporation bought a current equivalent of that device, they would probably all be using SSH now?
Probably not. I mean, some of this USB to serial stuff is quite arcane. There probably are versions of it that use... I think I'm going to have to drop my sensitivity down a bit here. There are obviously current devices that do use SSH and stuff, but not ones that have 16 ports in a 1RU form factor, in my experience, unfortunately.
Okay, fair enough. I don't want to spend a lot of time, but I was curious, and obviously it's not a concern on a remote bundle for student education, but I was thinking in the commercial setting that might be a concern.
Absolutely. Hang on, am I quiet, or is my volume good?
No, you're fine.
No, sounds good.
Okay, it's sensitivity fun times then. Okay.
You're sounding perfectly good to us. That is a question, though, because my understanding was that, I mean, if you're doing this sort of thing, you would want to make sure that no one could get in, and so you would, without, you know, proper authorization, and so you would use SSH. I'm kind of curious how you would stop unauthorized people from getting in. I mean...
Oh, come on. It's like 6 virtual workstations, 3 routers, and 3 switches. Who cares? The worst thing that's going to happen is they blow all the flash away on the routers and we put it back again, blow all the workstations away, we restore them from backup. The thing has no internet connectivity apart from the serial switch in, so it's just like, meh, who cares?
No. I mean, in a commercial environment.
Well, these things aren't designed to be necessarily internet accessible. They're only designed to be corporate network accessible. So on the corporate network, Telnet's just fine.
I see what you mean.
Yeah, so I would VPN connect possibly to my corporate network and then Telnet to the thing and do what I need to do.
That would be the theory. And in fact, what you are going to be able to do when I get this stuff stable... Oh, by the way, power cycling workstation 1 and 2 didn't bring workstation 2 back. So I think this will be a... I think this will be somewhat of an advanced troubleshooting thing later on today. So I think we may have a corrupted virtual machine image, which happens. Well, there's no way to actually tell the Linux machines to shut down cleanly with VMware that we could find. So we can actually do a remote power off of the virtual machine, but it just kills it. So once in every 30 or 40 times, it will corrupt the file system. And that's just how it is. Okie dokie. Now, the labs in Module 2 and the labs in Module 3, one of the other students had the idea, and I would strongly suggest this to people, is if you have VMware Player installed, Player will be sufficient. If you have something better than Player, that's fine. Workstation's good. You may wish to download the Base Etch Stable Linux Virtual Machine. And there are two reasons why you might want to do this. One is so that you've got a local Linux machine on your... machine, and you can change it from NATed to bridged. I think they're NATed by default. Yeah, they are. But you can change that to bridged, and it will actually get an IP on your actual network if you need it to do that. And you can then, once you've got that, two reasons why you might want to do this. One is because you'll have a copy of TCP dump that you can run on the virtual machine and look at its output. If you're happy with T-Shark, then no need to do that. But the other one is that you can go to the IP address of your Linux machine /dwww and get access to all the man pages, readmes, and stuff in a web browser. And that makes a lot of people very happy.
That would have expedited my education this weekend on you learning Ed.
I was actually at a technology show this weekend, so sort of Friday, Saturday, we were showing people new technology. Ramona says hello, by the way. We were fairly busy running around going, this is an insert funky device and you'd want it because stuff. So I didn't actually sort of get back to email till Sunday afternoon, which is why my replies on messages have been a bit tardy, so I apologise for that, but it was a pretty full-on weekend. IP address of virtual machine /dwww will give you access to all of the man pages, and they're searchable and stuff, and the info pages and the readme pages. And yes, you can read the Ed man page there. Although, if you do a search for Ed manual page, you'll find one on manpages.de, which is up to date. You don't have to use Ed. I can hear a few of you all just running quietly there going, we're not using Ed, we're using Nano or Pico or Joe or AE or whatever it is you're using. Gemma does have an RC file that will clean up the Nano screen. So if anybody wants that .nano RC, they're welcome to it. It's up to you guys which editor you use on the Linux machines. I tend to like the line-based ones, but then again, I'm a little bit old school in that respect.
I tried nano first because everyone told me to do so, and I did not have good results at cursor tracking and so on. I think I'll stick with Ed as long as I get more comfortable. You know exactly what's going on.
The trick with nano is to turn the help window off with Control XH. I think it is to turn the help window off, and then that gets better. And then Gemma's Nano RC will turn off the cursor location and the status bars. But the problem with cursor tracking on a terminal, and I've yet to ever find a good solution to this, is when you get to the bottom of the screen and you cursor down, it's fine. It reads the next line that you cursor down onto. But when you go back up, it doesn't track it as if you're in a Word document TM, patent pending. So what ends up happening is you go back up. Sorry, I should say virtual buffer. No, actually, I shouldn't say virtual buffer. I might get into trouble. Somebody might have trademarked virtual buffer. Okay, that's my trademark joke for the day. Yeah, like it does in a virtual buffer. So when you go back up, you end up with it not reading the line you land on. So if you have a Braille display, often your best option is to insert S to change speech to none and then read the lines on the Braille display, because the cursor will track, but the lines won't necessarily adequately read. But that's not an option for everyone, I fully admit that. Not that it's relevant to this lecture, but for the three people that care, there is now a module for NVDA that reads the TeamTalk chat. So if you're using TeamTalk and NVDA, we can fix you up with that, and it will read the chat automatically if you want that sort of thing. We don't have something like that for Ventrilo because it's not really needed, but that module now exists. Okay, any other questions that arose from last week and the wobbles of the bundle and that sort of thing? Anybody else got any, or any other general questions on what we've covered so far?
Yeah, this might be a silly question, but regarding using the Linux virtual machine, does that include any kind of speech synthesizer or any kind of screen access, or do we have to install that ourselves, or should we telnet into it, or how should we get access to that?
Okay, this is covered in the VMware instructions file, but basically what they are is you SSH into them, and there's actually painful instructions if you're on Windows. I don't know how you do it on the Mac, but there will be a way of how you actually boot the virtual machine and then dig into the VNet c.dhcp leases file and actually look at what lease was handed out to the virtual machine so that you know which IP address to SSH into. So yes, you SSH into them, and no, I deliberately did not install any SpeakUp, Orca, Scredder, BRLTTY, or any of that stuff, because getting the sound systems to function with eSpeak under virtual environments is somewhat of a challenge that I didn't want to get myself into for what we were doing. I may look at doing those sort of machines later on, but if you've ever spoken to any Linux advocates that have played with Pulse Audio, Alsa, OpenSound, eSpeak, any of that sort of stuff, you'll find that they probably will get quite upset and jump up and down about how it all doesn't behave itself.
Okay, thanks. I'll just read the instructions then.
Look, if this goes for everybody, if you have questions after you've read the instructions, I'm more than happy to answer them. I really am. But we spend a lot of time on that files to try and shortcut everybody to get up and running. The other thing I will mention, and this is not supported, but you can import our virtual machines into Fusion. I know you have a Mac, David, so you can run them on the Mac. There's absolutely no reason why you can't. I just don't have documentation for how to do that at this point in time.
I believe it's just under the menu there. There's an import option on the file menu, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think there is. You go File, Import, and then you point it at the VMDK, VMX, etc., etc., and then it shovels it into Fusion's package format, if my memory serves. I haven't played with Fusion for a lot because I used to have laggy sound cards, and then finally Patrick Perdue told me a few weeks ago that if you plug in a USB sound device and point the virtual machine at the USB sound device, it all goes so much faster and it makes Fusion usable. So I may have to look at it again.
I can confirm that makes a huge difference.
There's also a PCI delay parameter you can change in the VMX and drop it down to like 32 or 16 or something. I saw another article that says if you drop that PCI delay down, that will also improve your sound latency under Fusion.
I have several Mac friends that have confirmed that that is true.
And if you drop it too low, the thing blows up.
That's exactly right.
Oh.
It's alright. Show them the shiny lights. Okie dokie. They're just wandering in to show the remote bundle, which is all good, and they'll be quite noisy in there. Don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-Mac. I personally don't like Macs much. However, I'm quite happy if Mac people want to innovate and find ways to get stuff to work on their Mac, I'll be really happy. And if you happen to document how you did it, I'll be even happier, because that's going to go up on the site somewhere. So we don't officially support Macs, but they are a valid platform, and we know they exist. But given the volume of accessibility material that we're already teaching to get people up and running under Windows, we're not so keen to bring the Mac into the mix, because it's another modality of operating. So yeah, you can pull the machines into Fusion. You can pull our Windows machine into Fusion if you want a Windows virtual machine. You can also run them on VMware Server, VMware Player, etc. No, it's not very happy. It went to Hans to get fixed.
Hi.
Hello, thank you, Leah. Oh, here comes... Thank you. Tea and a Lamington, and you guys wouldn't know what Lamingtons are, so you'd have to look them up on Wikipedia, but oh, they're good. Alright, so, Linux virtual machines, I'm going to build some new ones. Somebody asked me why they're ancient versions of Debian. I would argue for what you're doing in this course that Apache 1.3 and a version of Debian that works and is small to download is perfectly adequate. If anybody would like to fight it out with me otherwise, I'd be more than happy to hear your complaints. But they're a good starting point if you're just dabbling in Linux at the command line. Yes, they do have a web server on them, and I think I even set email up on them. But yeah, so grab the Linux virtual machines and have a play. It's perfectly safe, and you might learn some interesting things. We don't want to turn you all into Linux whizzes at the end of this course, but I think that being a little bit familiar with Linux would also be quite useful, especially if you want to hack the Victor Reader stream. Just kidding. But it actually does run Linux, and you can actually tear apart its firmware images, and there's a little ARM-based Linux in there, and it's all lots of fun. And you shouldn't do that, because it'll invalidate your warranty, but you can. Okay, any other questions? Do we want to go through this bandwidth? Oh, sorry, did somebody...
John did.
Oh, sorry, John, yes. You did put your name in, and I forgot. I'm terribly sorry.
Okay, the question is, when the one lab in Chapter 2 had us basically disconnect from the network and then try ping something, and I just wondered where the destination unreachable comes from when you do that.
Ah, the destination unreachable comes from your local network stack. That is actually returned by your local network stack. So when the interface goes down and it can't actually talk to the IP addresses that are locally bound on the machine, it actually comes up and says destination unreachable, and that comes from your local machine.
Okay, thank you.
How are people finding the labs? I know they're a bit challenging at the moment, but are people muddling through? Because, I mean, we can provide extra resources and stuff if we need to, and I'll expect some guidance from you guys on what sort of extra resources we want. I'm also thinking of setting up a PM wiki, thank you, Chris, on qcat.org. If anybody is interested in adding tips and hints to our PM wiki, you'd be more than welcome to do so. Obviously we're going to have to find ways of locking it down and stuff, which I'll be looking into. There are ways, of course, to do that, but we are looking at possibly feeding some of this stuff into a wiki for future students, which will make their lives somewhat easier.
Yeah, it's Jason. It'd be nice if we could figure out a way to do on the was it, I guess it was module three, the IMAP lab, that portion of it. I thought about trying to set it up on my own, but I just didn't. But yeah, that might be good if we could do that.
Hang on, didn't I mention that you could go app-get install dovecot on the virtual machine and that it would come up and talk IMAP and you could be a happy camper? Or did I not write that in?
I don't think
because
so.
I can. Ah, all right, okay, so that means I've got to edit that lab. Yeah, what you can do is if you really feel you want to see IMAP and stuff working is download the Linux virtual machine image, app-get install dovecot, and you will have a fully functional IMAP setup. Actually, probably Courier IMAP would be simpler. So app-get install Courier IMAP, and you would be able to talk IMAP to your virtual machine with your mail client. We have two groups of students, one group of students which is quite happy to reconfigure and break everything, and another group of students that absolutely point blank refuses to change their setting in their mail client or set up a new account. No, 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 I'm not adding that in. So we've obviously got the former group this year rather than the latter, so I was a bit sort of hesitant to get people to set up IMAP servers because I thought people might not want to.
Injecting the messages into PostFix is still pretty slick, though, and to be able to see step-by-step what the acknowledgements and so on, that's good.
Yeah, look, that was a good sort of work-through solution, and it does actually inject them in quite nicely, and then they turn up in the mail spool, which I thought was a nice sort of, look, this is sort of how it works. And whilst it's not exactly what the lab does, it does sort of teach you the hard way about how SMTP works. Making you type it in at the command line to get it to go. Now, just as a random poll, and we're just getting interest at the moment. But if ever we got funding for a Linux course, would anybody be interested?
Yes, yes, yes.
Definitely.
Yes, definitely.
I would probably be interested.
I'm sure I could succeed in teaching you something, Nehemiah. I'm sure we'd find something you hadn't covered. Grin. Okay, I'll keep that in mind, and I'll let the powers that be know. All right. Now, does anybody have any questions on the content of Chapter 3 apart from the bandwidth lab? Because I sort of read it all and just went. I mean, obviously, I've been doing this for years, so I mean, I could be completely wrong. But I sort of read it and said there's not really a lot of anything in Chapter 3 except for sort of explaining of the applications layer. But does anybody need any edges on that clarified? I'll assume that's a no. All right. Okay. Well, basically, it talks about the application layer and how you have all sorts of applications, and the applications that run on your computer are things like web server, web browsers and email clients and all that sort of stuff. And obviously, that's fairly well covered. Now, before we get on to Module 4 and the bits and pieces of Module 4, did anybody have a look at the binary labs? And does anybody have any questions on binary? Because it's okay. If the penny hasn't dropped yet, you realise you're going to be walking along one day with the dog down some street, if you've got a dog, or with a significant other, which is completely different, and you'll suddenly go, oh, I completely understand how this binary stuff works. And they'll look at you as if you're mad. But you'll be happier, and they will probably be happier because you're not worried about this binary stuff. So, any questions, clarifications on binary? Does people want me to quickly go over procedures and stuff in binary to try and solidify it a bit more?
Hi, Gary, it's Barry.
It actually is not. It's not bad. It's funny. My girlfriend, I talked to her about it, and she's been sending me text messages with binary in it to make me practice. But I think she's got it quicker than I did.
It's always good.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
Kerry, could you quickly go over the process again, please, for the decimal, the binary, and the other way around?
Oh, I certainly can. Well, I think everybody could do with a little bit of revision anyway, so we'll whip through that again and see how we go. The only thing I was going to say is now all you've got to do is, on the next Valentine's card or whatever, write "you are the one to my zero" and see if that gets the, intended.
Oh,
yes, Matthew.
Oh.
I looked at the binary files and extras like you said, and the conversions I think I've got. Well, I'll find out in a moment when you go over it again, but I also saw that there was a second file there that I had a look at and was absolutely terrified.
Ah, agreed. That's the subnet one? That's chapter 6. Don't touch that one.
No, but it was labeled as... I didn't even look at the subnetting ones, but no, this one was labeled binary exercises 2 or something, but it was all about... you know, a top-level project, and I said, no way.
Ah, all right, I'll go have a look at that and see how terrifying it really is and see if I can Oh, was that the one where I was talking about, like, a whole stack of machines and we were going to put them onto different subnets? Was that in Binary Exercise 2 where you had busy builders? Was that the one?
No, this is the one where you're doing setting up the networking and the servers and the plan for offices all around Australia.
Oh, I mean, we'll cover that soon. Promise. We will explain how that works. And you will know how to do that. Oh, the one with Perth and Adelaide and... Yeah, I remember the one now. Yep, I do.
Yeah, that's...
We'll cover that. Yeah, it's okay. In fact, no, we won't. We won't pretend they're Humanware offices or Freedom Scientific offices. But we could, and it wouldn't be just as relevant. But as a matter of fact, these are just, you know, generic offices, and we will cover enough theory so that if you had to do this, you could actually go out and do that. And a lot of what I'm going to cover fairly soon after I've done the binary, like with the subnetting and stuff, that will teach you how to calculate those things. Now, Barry gave me this thing called 256chart.txt, which is quite useful. I haven't handed it out yet because I am pretty sure that 90% of people will run screaming from their PCs because you don't yet know enough to understand what 256chart.txt tells you. But it does work, and it is a good way of doing the subnetting, and it is a handy-dandy shortcut. So that will go up on the site under Terrifying Documents for Exploration soon. All right. Now, we remember that we had our table of powers of 2. Does everybody still have their table of powers of 2? Or do I need to go through those powers again and people can write it down or something?
It's Barry again, just for the recording. Is that the... You have like 32, 64, 128, that kind of
thing? Don't forget
yes.
0 and 1. I mean...
Yep, so we have 2 to the power of 7 is 128, 6 is 64, 5 is 32, 4 is 16, 3 is 8, 2 is 4, 1 is 2, 0 is 1. Just in case you didn't have that table handy. So we have 2 to the power of 7 is 128, 2 to the power of 6 is 64, 2 to the power of 5 is 32, 2 to the power of 4 is 16, 2 to the power of 3 is 8, 2 to the power of 2 is 4, 2 to the power of 1 is 2, and 2 to the power of 0 is 1. That is the table I'm talking about.
And you, after you do enough of these exercises, or just have to do this enough times, you do really remember all that. Promise.
Yeah, you do. What actually happens is you eventually learn those 7, 8 powers of 2, and they stick in your head, so that as soon as you see one of those numbers, you go, oh, that's 2 to the power, you see 32, and you go, oh, that's 2 to the power of 5. And then you wonder where your life went, and then you go out and have dinner somewhere so that you get your life back. But the point is that you do actually learn these powers of 2 eventually, and this makes the process a lot quicker. What I would recommend is, if you're not quick at it at this point, put the table into some sort of note taker if you're lucky enough to have one, or into the notes application of an iDevice if you're lucky enough to have one, or on a piece of braille paper for a Perkins if you're lucky enough to have one, or if you're the slate and stylus type, braille this table out, or something, or have it all tabbable. Okay, has everybody got that table or a facsimile of it or some idea of what I just talked about, so that if I start talking about powers of 2, you won't all look at me as blankly?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
Alrighty, now, to convert any... which way do we want to go? We'll go from decimal to binary. Any binary number is a series of ones and zeros. Yeses and nos, whatever you want to call them, ons and offs. And the combination of these ones and zeros can make up any positive integer based on which powers of two are added together to get the particular number. Do we have to, like, scream wake up at the end of this, Chris, so that you don't fall asleep or something? Ah, it may have already happened. Okay. So basically the aim of the game is to find out which powers of two add up to make the number that you want to convert into binary. Now, I have a funky method that involves less jumping around than some of the other methods, but we'll just work my method, and if somebody has a better method, they can come in and give it. So that's fine. I'm all for different methods. We did have one student who sort of came into the lectures a few years ago and went, "Ah, well, I just do this with logarithms," and I'm just like, "Yes, well, you can do that, but I don't think anybody else here is going to do that." All right. So
some
the aim of the game is to
just work that way.
Well, yeah, he's entitled to his methods. All right. So the trick is to find out if you're converting any number from binary into a decimal. No, from decimal into binary even, let me get it right. From decimal into binary. Let's convert the number 87. Okay, so we have the number 87. Can somebody tell me what the largest power of 2 that you can subtract from... Oh, you're allowed to use Windows Calculator for this stuff, or another calculator, but Windows Calculator tends to be nice and fast. In all seriousness, does anybody know of a good calculator app on the Mac? I must admit, I cracked the terminal and used BC, which is kind of cheating. Actually, give me Ian. Can you just crack a terminal for me for 5 seconds and see whether you've got BC on your Mac? Bravo, as in Bravo Charlie.
I can check if you want.
Ah, you guys do have BC on your Mac. Thank you. That's all I need. Quid will get you out of that. And okay. If you want to check your answers with BC, you can go IBase equals 2, OBase equals 10, and then you can key in binary and hit enter, and it'll come out with decimal.
I don't know if anyone would find this useful, but I discovered with checking my answers with Windows Calculator that F8 switches to binary mode and F6 switches to decimal mode, so you don't have to go to the view menu.
That is very true. And in Windows 7 you want to go into programmer mode, not scientific.
I was going to say, I haven't actually played with it in Windows 7 yet.
I have to check out BC now.
It's very cool. It's an arbitrary precision calculator, and you can actually go, like, scale equals 304, and then do a calculation, and it will give you 304 decimal places. It's pretty impressive.
Jeez.
64, Kerry, for the number.
That is correct. Yeah, 64 is our first one. So we've taken off 64 from 87, so I'll just put a 1. Let me do that. 87, 27, 23 is what we're left with, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Okay. Can we subtract 32?
No.
Nope.
Right. Scribe and Z is 0. So you got 1, 0. Can you subtract 16 from 23?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, you can. So scribe and Z are 1. And you are left with 7. Can you subtract 8 from 7?
No.
No.
No, so write a 0. Can you subtract 4 from 7?
Yes.
Yes, you can, so put a 1. You're left with 3. So obviously we know that 3 is made up of a 2 and a 1, just because that's easy, so we can put 1, 1. So what we end up with, 10101111 is 87 in binary.
Very cool.
And as you, I'm just going to throw this in here because I've done this off and on after a while. As you do this, you really do get used to doing this to the point that it does, I mean, it becomes almost, I'm not going to quite say second nature, but it becomes something that you can do without a whole lot of thought as long as you do it fairly often. And even when you take a break from it, because I took quite a while break from it, and once I start doing it again, it does come back to you. So it's something once you learn, and once you get enough practice in it, it does become pretty easy to do.
Yeah, and I've been...
Go ahead.
Oh, I just said I've just been practicing with random numbers throughout the week, just all in my head, just to see if I can do it, and I can't say I'm successful all the time, but generally speaking, if you keep at it and just try to, because I intend to take that test, the certification, and so I want to be able to do it as much in my head as I can. So generally, it gets a little easier as you practice and just pick random numbers and try to convert.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, when you get good at it, you start seeing shortcuts. So say, for example, we were to do the number 107. So let's do it the Kerry shortcut way. And if your head explodes from doing this, ignore me, all right? You can just ignore this bit. So 107, we know that 64 is going to come off. We know that 32 is going to come off. So we put 1. So 96 from 107 gives us 11. We then know that if we're going to convert 11, so we've got no 16, so we'll put a 0. We do have an 8, so we put a 1. We don't have a 4, so we put a 0. We do have a 2 and a 1, so we go 1. So there's the answer of 107 into binary. Now, admittedly, I took some shortcuts, but it might give you some idea as to the sort of shortcuts you can take. You'll know that when you look at the things, and depending on how big the numbers are, you'll start realizing that if the number's bigger than a certain thing, then certain powers of two are going to be there automatically. So, for example, if it's bigger than 96, you've got to have a 64 and a 32 to get there. So you might as well just put those ones down anyway. So if it's bigger than 96, it's got to start with 1.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Another cross-check is that if the number is even, the last digit has to be 0. Because if it's odd, the last digit is going to be 1. So if you have an odd number and the last digit is 0, you've botched it. Okay, would anybody like me to revisit anything or go over anything again? Because that was a bit of a flying visit, but I'm hoping that you just simply follow that procedure. Find the largest power of 2 that will come off. Subtract it, write a 1. Then if the next power of 2 won't come off, write a 0. If the next power of 2 won't come off, write a 0. Then, when the next power of 2 comes off, write a 1. And that is the procedure. That is just it. That's repeated subtraction. That's all we're doing. If you're a long division person and you used to do HMS bring down, which was one way of doing it, and then there was the other one that was repeated subtraction, we're doing repeated subtraction with the remainders. That's all we're doing.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Now I'm behind in the reading. They're only doing binary at this point, right?
Yeah. I don't think they do hex. I don't think they do hex. Has anyone seen hex in the notes yet? I hope they don't do hex.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. They will at some point. Don't worry.
Okay, it's true, right, that a MAC address is made out of hex, right?
It's made of bits, and often the bits are represented in hexadecimal. So you get, 6 pairs of 2 hex digits separated by something, either spaces, colons, dots, depending on who's doing the MAC address.
Right.
Dots, dashes, sometimes colons are how most common.
Right. I get colons in Linux.
I usually see colons, but I just wondered because looking at them, they look very hexish to me. So I just thought I'd add.
Sorry.
Yeah, all right, let's spend 40 seconds. Let's spend 40 seconds blowing people's brains up, and then we'll move on. Basically, what hex does is it converts a binary nibble, which is 0 to 15, or 0000 to 1111, into a 0 to 9 or A to F. So A is 10, B is 11, C is 12, D is 13, E is 14, and F is 15. So what you do is you break your binary up into nibbles, four-bit chunks, and then you convert those four-bit chunks into the decimal numbers, and then you convert those decimal numbers. If they're above 10, you turn them into a letter. And that's how you convert to hexadecimal. But we don't have to do it. But just in case you wanted to know.
Kerry, when do they require you to start knowing about IPv6? Because I know those addresses scare the crap out of me.
They don't at the moment. Okay, how IPv6 works is there are 128-bit addresses. You really shouldn't be looking at them too often from a static perspective. You should probably be doing these as with the DHCP6 and those sorts of things. But basically, there are 128-bit addresses. They are four hexadecimal digits separated by colons, and there are eight pairs of four. And you can do what we call zero suppression, which is where you take the longest run of zeros and you take that out and just put a colon, zero colon, and that will allow you to shorten up the addresses. And that's basically how they work, in a nutshell. Now, I'm not saying that they're hugely easy to work with, but... So, you might end up with an address like 2A00:2A00:4BF1:3B74:0000. And that's basically how the IPv6 works. I shouldn't say basic, should I?
No.
Okay. That's how the incredibly complex IPv6 works.
I think I felt my headache start to come back right there.
It's... Well, I was about to say, I was explaining it to Tyler the other day, and I suppose I shouldn't really say that, because, yeah. But it's not incredibly difficult, and if we want to do an extension lecture on IPv6, that can happen. I'm not saying that we should, or that we must, but we might actually... Or maybe a Friday chat on IPv6 might happen.
I think it probably would be a good idea, because sooner or later we're going to have to all deal with it. And possibly sooner than later, really, because more and more they're actually starting to wake up and smell the coffee.
Yeah, look, to be fair, I mean, I shouldn't say it's simple, because I've been looking at internet protocols since 1993, since I spent the first 3 days debugging my first network cable, and I didn't know what cable short 4 clocks away meant until I dragged it down to the local computer store, and he went, aha, you've got a short in your coax. Click, crimp. Try that. And then my network that I'd been working on for 3 days was able to ping between the two workstations. Wasn't I a happy camper? But you have to learn somewhere.
Kerry, not to totally go off on a tangent, but is there any way for a blind guy to crimp cables? I know we don't, you know, might be far off topic, but I'm just curious.
Well, it is on topic. We talked about this yesterday, actually. The answer is kind of, and probably not. Okay. See, what you've got to understand is you could get the wire map right. So if you get one of those talking testers from the NFB, or I think they sell them. I think NFB had them. You could get the wire map correct. But the problem is when you're working on gigabit cables, you've got to get the colours correct. Because if you don't get the colours correct, you end up with too much far-end crosstalk, which then makes your cable non-compliant. Now... Obviously, if a sighted person has trouble squinting at the wires, figuring out what colour they are, I don't hold much hope for a colour detector. So if somebody can prove me wrong, I'll be happy to hear from you. But honestly, go down to the shop and buy a cable. Really? I mean, maybe you could crimp them up yourself and it'd be a cool thing to be able to do. But to be honest with you... If you're doing a small home job, you're probably just going to buy 6 cables of the approximate length you want. And if you don't have the approximate length, then buy some ends and get your mate over with a crimping tool and a carton of beer or beverage of their choice to shorten the cables up for you. And if you're doing a big cabling job, you're probably paying a cabling contractor. I mean, I hate to be so, you probably shouldn't be doing this about it, but you probably shouldn't. I mean, if you can, that'd be kind of cool, but I'm happy to buy cables. I bought a box of 20 off eBay for $30. It was amazing, and they all worked.
Yeah, okay. I was just curious. I mean, I didn't think so, but I was curious.
I think I've heard of one blind guy that was able to do it, but I can't swear to the story is true.
Look, there are some blind people who can solder. There are some blind people who might be able to crimp. My wife 1.0, who had 5% vision, said it wasn't enough vision to be able to do cable crimping. She could do the phone cables, but she couldn't do the Ethernet cables. And she was somewhat sad about it, but she's like, no, it's just too hard, and it's too much squinting. The other fun story we had a friend who had who had bipolar, and she was over crimping some cables for us, and we handed her the crimping tools and the cables and the colour map, and there was like 15 minutes of dead silence, and at the end of the 15 minutes she had like 6 cables and they all worked, and she's like, congratulations guys, I'm going to have to tell my mother you finally found something that makes me shut up, crimping cables. So we all had a bit of a chuckle. Okay, shall we quickly run through going back the other way from binary to decimal?
Yes, please.
All right, let's take the number 10101011. Okay, 1010... What did I say? I want my Focus 40 blue and I want it today. And no, I'm not bringing my Brilliant in from home. 10101011 is what we got. You can work from whichever way you like. I prefer to work from the right. If you don't want to work from the right, then that's fine. You can do it yourself.
I've always worked from the left.
But you know how long the number is, and you know what the biggest power of 2 is going to be. You actually have to count the number of bits in the number to work from the left. Whereas with my method, and you're working from the right, you don't have to count the number of bits, and you can just keep going with bigger and bigger powers of 2 until you get the right answer. But as I said, you do it whichever way you like. All right, so we've got 1, 1. So the right-hand 1 is worth 1. Everybody happy with that? Because that's the lowest number of power of 2 thing, jiggamy, right?
Right.
The next digit across is worth, which says 1, so it's worth 2. So we've got 1 and 2. So at the moment, I'm just writing down the powers of 2. Because I'm going to add them up later. And then we've got a 0, so we have no 4s. Everybody cool with that?
Yep.
Okay, but we do have a 1 for the 8s, so we write 8 down. We have no 16s, so we don't write 16 down. We have a 1 for 32, so we write 32 down. Yeah, my brain is shorting out. We have no 64s, so we write a 0. And we have one lot of 128, so we write... That's not what I write. I want to want... Okay, I have no 64s, and I have 128. So now, it just becomes a matter of adding 128 plus 32 plus 8 plus 2 plus 1 will give us the answer we want. So let's see, 128 plus 32 is 38, 48, 58, 160, plus 8 is 168, plus 2 is 170, plus 1 is 171. I think it should be 171.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. I got a different one, but I think I could have written it down wrong too.
It was 10101011, in case you had the wrong thing written down.
I've got binary to decimal down, can do those in my head most of the time, so small victories, right? Nowhere close to being able to do it the other direction.
Look, you get scribble paper. So basically what happens is you can tell them what to write and get them to read you back. So you can say, I want you to write the following numbers down on the piece of paper. Now, what numbers did you write down for me? That is permissible. Now, the other way a friend of mine used to do them with the 256-bit quantities, and this sounds really stupid, But what he did was, is he had his fingers above the 1 to 8 on the number row, and for each bit that he wanted to put on, he would put his finger down, and that way he could keep track of which bits he'd set, which is a bit silly, but it would probably work. Now, I realise it's going to take a bit more practice. Are you somewhat happier with that, Barry? I mean, I know it's not all going to fall into place straight away,
no,
but...
Oh, good. I've very much had a eureka moment over here.
Oh, good. Okay, well, don't hit the Guinness until after the lecture, because we might have a few more eureka moments, and then you then you can hit as much of it as you like.
Oh, the thought of alcohol makes me quiver.
Oh, fair enough. It was that good yesterday, was it? Okay. All right, so did anybody else find that somewhat enlightening and summary stuff? I might actually have a record and actually have binary down in two lectures. We will do some more practice, believe me. But is anybody else a bit happier with that now? At least with another run through of the process?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, much less scary this week.
Oh, good. To be honest with you, I do have people that, you know, as soon as I say mathematics, they don't take exploration. And whilst I respect that, we are only talking about adding numbers together, and I will actually let you do the adds on the calculator to speed things up, unless you're doing the actual exam. The only reason I'm doing it in my head is I'm sort of inversely too lazy to press all the buttons on the calculator, which is silly. But my head will give me the results I want, so, yeah, it's all good. Oh, look, dare I start talking about subnetting, or shall I go on to something else?
No, something else.
All right, we'll do something else. I don't think you actually get a say, Marshall. You're not enrolled, Grin. But yes, I will go on to something else. I'm just stirring, by the way.
No, I just wondered what was the something else. I can't make a choice unless I know what my option.
Transport layer, about segmentation and packet reassembly and sequencing and all that sort of good stuff in Chapter 4. Oh, no, we've got to do a bandwidth calculation. I'd almost forgotten the bandwidth calculation. Okay. Transfer speed. How long is it going to take me to download Paris Hilton's latest video? Okay, this is the sort of question we're answering. Now, I wouldn't condone the downloading of Paris Hilton's latest video. It may not be family safe. But we are going to download the latest Paris Hilton video, which is 688 megabytes in size. And we are going to download Ms. Hilton on various types of links. Now, what you've got to understand about bandwidth calculations is it's a speed-time-distance thing. So you've basically got three variables, and you've got one over the other, and that's basically how it works. So you know how when you do cars and you go, look, I'll even do it in miles because I'm feeling nice. No, I won't, actually. This car is travelling at 40 kilometres per hour. If Jim drove for 4 hours, how far would he go? Can anybody tell me if he's going at 40 kilometres an hour?
Are we assuming that he is constantly moving at 40 with no variation?
160.
We are. Yeah, 160. Yeah, he's at 40 kilometres an hour. He's, you know, I don't know what he's doing, but this, for the case of this math problem, he's going constantly at 40 kilometres an hour for 4 hours. So he's going to go 160 kilometres. Does that follow everybody? Everybody cool with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, but say for example, let's flip the question around a bit. Let's say that Jim has travelled 160 kilometres. If he has travelled for 2 hours, what speed was he going? So how would people do that?
Divide it by two.
Yes, you're dividing the distance travelled by the time. Well, yeah, you're dividing the distance by the time, because he's travelling the same speed. Jim is boring. He drives at the same speed all the time. In fact, he's got an amazing car that goes from 0 to 40 kilometres instantly for our math problem, which is a pretty amazing car. I'd like one of those. But in fact, this time we divide 160 by 2, and he was travelling at 80 kilometres per hour. Everybody happy with that? Apart from the realism of the problem.
Jim has whiplash.
Yeah, he probably does, actually. It's probably just, boom, off you go. You know, Jim is not a happy camper. All right. Now, bandwidth, speed, and time stuff works similarly. Now, I don't know whether anybody is familiar with how the internet works. That's a stupid thing to say. Downloading files off the internet works. Has anybody ever sort of heard people or in their very early days of computing, and it's okay, you can admit to this if you want, we won't hold it against you, wondered why when you start downloading something with, insert your browser of choice, we'll pick Internet Explorer, that it starts really fast and then it slows down and it goes down to a lower number and then it lies about how long it's got left. Has anybody experienced this phenomenon? Internet Explorer lies about how long it's going to take. Or whatever browser it is, you know. Why can't they tell me how long it's going to take? Everyone seen this?
I've seen it, well, or start slow, fast, slow, fast, slow.
Isn't this what I was talking to you about last week, Terry, after class? What I observed with the packet tree, or the packet sniff?
Maybe, but to be honest with you, I've had such a... I can't remember, and I'd actually have to... I'm really sorry, but I've probably said sensible things, but I've probably forgotten.
Where when you click a link to download a file, even while you're waiting to choose what to do with the file, it's already busily downloading it to a temporary file.
Oh, yes, sorry. Okay, the neurons have just reconnected. I'm good now. Sorry about that. But, okay, what happens is, and I want to talk about this because it is somewhat important. A lot of you will know about this, and a lot of you won't know about this. Some of you will have had more experience with this than others, so we'll just talk about it. So, let's just keep this simple. You've got a link that goes at 1,000 kilobytes a second. It's an amazing link. I don't know who you bought it from, but it goes at 1,000 kilobytes per second, and it always goes at 1,000 kilobytes per second. If you are going to download 688,000 kilobytes because you are deciding that you do want to watch Paris Hilton in her latest video, how many seconds will it take you to download this, given that the link is going at 1,000 kilobytes per second and you have to download 688,000 kilobytes?
Bytes or bits?
The link is measured in kilobytes per second because I'm keeping it simple. So everything is in kilobytes. We do not need to do any unit conversions. Can anybody see that if we had 688,000 kilobytes and we were running at 1,000 kilobytes per second, it would take 688 seconds for the file to download?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, now we introduce a wrinkle into our calculations and stuff. Alright, but what I want to talk about is, so you start downloading something, and while you're figuring out where to save, Internet Explorer or whatever is downloading the thing into a temporary file. So what happens is it doesn't actually start the download timer until you hit the save button. So as far as it's concerned, you got 3 megabytes in 0 seconds, which is why you see a really high figure as to how fast it's going. And then as time elapses, you end up with the average causing the average of speed over time falling as more time elapses and more data comes down. So everybody's seen that perhaps? In fact, some of you who perhaps were too bored on a Friday afternoon with a Braille display have actually sort of jaws cursored or window eyes cursored down to the download thing and watched the numbers changing. I know I have.
Oh yeah.
Yep, I'm impatient, so I watch it when I'm downloading something.
I mean, the other thing you do is, and in fact, if you thought that was fun with Internet Explorer downloading, you should try it with MuTorrent, because there's peers and seeds and all sorts of things. Okay, guys. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, isn't it kind of mixing it all together into one? Like, so that it's trying to calculate the average from all the different peers or seeds or whatever.
Yeah, it does. It mixes it together in such a way that it averages it out. I'm not going to talk too much about MuTorrent here because, I mean, obviously the only reason you'd be using MuTorrent would be to be downloading freely distributable music or Linux distributions or very popular files.
Is it saying Linux distribution?
Yeah, for example, PBX in a Flash has a torrent and you can download it from the torrent. We actually toyed with torrenting lectures, but I just never fired the tracker up. It'd be kind of cool if you could torrent a semester of lectures down. Some people would do it.
Yeah, some bad podcasts I listen to are available on torrent.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, because everybody else is uploading bits of the file, it actually becomes much more efficient to distribute copies of things. So not that I was, of course, involved with this, because I wouldn't do such a thing. But other people, when Harry Potter Book 7 came out and the MP3s hit the shelf, somebody ramped up a copy of CDEX and torrented the entire of Book 7. And because they had limited bandwidth, it meant that once you got 3, 4, 10, 15, 20 seeds, everybody else who wanted it could get Harry Potter at a very high speed.
At least that's what they all told you.
That's exactly right. That's what they all said. And they said it got really fast once you had like a whole lot of seeds in the swarm. Actually, to be honest about it, I actually did buy myself a copy of Book 7. So in this particular instance, I was actually completely legit and I can wave the CD packet under your nose. So, you know, there you go. But, I mean, obviously some people have torrented a few things. In fact, in my experience of travelling on the buses and trains... What's a student password? Student. We keep it simple.
Yeah, I'm gonna try a password
and then again. No, student. So if ever you're logging into the lab, the student password is student, but I don't think too many of you will be over here. So basically what it comes down to is, when you look at these download things, they are a speed thing averaged over time. And the only time you can know how long it really took and how fast it came down was if you uncheck that closed dialog when complete, and at the end of it, Internet Explorer says downloaded 604 megs in 13 minutes and 26 seconds, and it has the speed at the end. Now, this actually comes into interesting topics that I can't talk about right now because we haven't actually done enough to do so, but we talk about traffic control and queuing and prioritization and quality of service and VoIP and torrents and all sorts of stuff. And I think I'm gearing up to do a Friday chat on that, which will probably enlighten about 4 people and confuse 27. But it should be interesting. So watch out for a Thursday/Friday chat near you. Now, so what you do, what you've got to understand is that there are two forms of bandwidth. One is analog bandwidth, and that's usually measured in megahertz. So you end up with, you know, 100 megahertz, 200 megahertz, 50 megahertz, whatever the analog bandwidth. And the other measure of bandwidth is digital bandwidth. And digital bandwidth is measured in bits per second. Can anybody hear the underlines? Bits per second. That is what it is measured in. I don't care what other measurements you happen to see. They are sub-measurements of the other things. Now, the other thing to keep in mind about bandwidth is a megabit is 1 million bits per second. A kilobit is 1,000 bits per second. A gigabit is 1 billion bits per second. And some people say that the reason that people do this is because the Australian ISPs want to charge you more on your volume, and if a megabit was actually 1,048,576 bits, you would get more bits and they actually want to charge you more. No, it's actually measured in thousands, millions, billions, etc. So, if bandwidth is measured in bits per second, what unit do we need our file size in to be able to do calculations with it?
Bits.
Bits.
That's correct. How do we convert the number of bytes in a file into the number of bits?
Google. By 8.
You do not use Google. Although, you can. You can.
That was the best answer I've heard in the last 2 days.
There is certainly a calculator on Google, and you get extra points for going to the help page and figuring out, you know, how to, you know, the fact that it can do cups and ounces and temperature and, you know, pressure and all sorts of things. You only get, like, you know, small amounts of marks if you just do the... Yeah, but no, seriously? Yes, you can do it with Google, but you should probably multiply it by 8. And in fact, I was talking to one of the students via email about this. If you haven't seen it, there's a really good television show, which of course I can't possibly share with you, because I'm not that sort of person, called The IT Crowd. It's okay, that cough will clear up. It must be the weather. And it's called The IT Crowd, and it's certainly worth a watch. It's a British show, and it's very funny. And
great.
One of the things they... As soon as they answer the phone, the first thing they're like, "Hello, IT, can I help you? Have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again?" is the first question they ask. But, yeah, so The IT Crowd is quite good. And in one of the episodes, they ask, the woman asks this guy who works for IT, "How do you live like that?" And his mate goes, "No, don't Google it. Don't Google it." So not every answer is on Google, believe it or not. I know that's a horrible truth. But yet, to convert a file size in bytes to bits, you multiply by 8.
So, just as a quick refresher, when they show KB per second or MB per second, if it's a capital, I know it's 1, and it's lowercase, it's another. But I can't remember which uppercase or lowercase is megabytes or megabits or...
Ah, that's easy. Big B is bytes. Just hang on, this is probably important. Hello?
Capitalized is megabytes. Lowercase is bits.
Yes.
If they do it right. If.
Yeah, see, that's the problem. But okay, good to know.
I
find it amusing how my router, which runs, DDWRT firmware, has a bandwidth calculator thing. Well, it's a counter, and it keeps track monthly and weekly, has graphs and all that. But my ISP apparently has a counter too, and the numbers they give me seem to differ from what my router gives me, so I wonder who's right.
Interesting.
And yeah, no doubt the ISP claims you used more, right?
Generally speaking, yes.
Yeah, funny how that
Canada, we're in the in Canada, we're in the land of evil bandwidth caps. I don't think as bad as they are in Australia, but...
Ah, good old Rogers.
Yeah, I'm on Shaw.
Shaw, tell us them on the West Coast. All of them do it, huh?
Well, I dropped Rogers, actually, and went to another provider that doesn't do it, so, yeah.
I'm still holding out on, what used to be Quest, now is CenturyLink, because... my other choice is Comcast, and you know they do bandwidth caps now too. But CenturyLink doesn't.
That's why Jason's buying all of that Cisco gear on eBay, as he's going to start his own ISP.
I used to work for Comcast tech support.
I see his evil plan. You what, sir?
I used to work for Comcast technical support, and then indirectly.
I'll try not to hold it against you.
I won't get into that. Yeah, I could tell you stuff, but maybe later.
Calm, Craig.
Ask me about the lights on the front of my router. Go ahead, ask me.
Hey, you got 4 lights.
Sorry, guys, I'm
four
back.
Solidly.
Ah, we're talking IT Crowd. Okay, good stuff. No, sorry guys, that was a quest. I thought that was going to be Grace having trouble with at her medical, but it wasn't. It was somebody wanting me to tell them about Victorita streams, which I should probably do.
And how to hack the Linux.
Send them to me. I'll try. Can I charge them?
I'm doing this as a vision impairment service. I don't have much money. I haven't seriously hacked my Victor Reader stream. I just tore the image apart to see what was in there. And after all the Germans were jumping up and down about, it runs Linux and it should all be free. And I'm like, yeah, bull twang, but what is in this? So, yeah, got bored one Friday afternoon. I know, you'll all go and scramble your images in the next version just to thwart me. That's okay.
No, we're going to put your name in the credits, actually.
It would be funny. Okay, so... okay, I sort of got distracted, but we're converting the files into to bits, so you're multiplying... did somebody answer his question about big B is bytes and little B is bits? Did somebody answer that? Yeah, big B's bite you. That's how I remember it.
Fair enough. It inspired a whole discussion about ISPs and bandwidth, but we'll continue on.
Okay, no, that's okay. I mean, I really technically shouldn't take calls in lecture, but as I said, I thought it might have been an emergency, and it wasn't, and this person has obviously asked my help, and this is the first time in 11 years that the Vision Impairment Service has asked for my help, so I'm going to help them.
Don't worry about it. None of us want Grace deported.
Exactly. Well, you guys don't want her back over there, do you? Just kidding. Alright, no, we don't want it back over there either. Alright, so you get this file size and you multiply it by 8 and you get it in bits, and then you figure out what the link speed is in bits per second, megabits per second, or kilobits per second, and you divide the total file size in bits by the link speed in bits per second, and that will give you how long it takes to transfer the file in seconds. Once you get the seconds and a fractional number, so say it's 604.8 seconds, you can then subtract... what am I on about? Yeah, you can then convert that to minutes and seconds if you want by dividing by 60 and messing around with the remainders. Or, no doubt, Google probably has that in its calculator function. Honestly, guys, I have nothing against Google, but I want to know how you all function when you're disconnected from the internet. Very well. Okay. It seems that the modern computer technician is incredibly disabled if you disconnect them from the internet. It's kind of sad. We should still be able to fix things without an internet connection. I know, it sounds unreal, but we used to actually fix things without internet connections.
So we're going to do our video as an example.
Okay. Let's do the video as an example. All right. So if we've got it's 688 megabytes. Now here's where a wrinkle comes in. Now file sizes are expressed in megabytes, as in 2 to the power of 20, and we're not really interested in that. So we are going to convert this out into bits. Now, we remember that data megabits are millions of bits and file megabits are 1,048,576, or 2 to the power of 20. So what we're going to do is this file is just so happens to be 688 megabytes in size, because I'm making up this exercise. So we need to go 688, calculator time, times 1,048,576. So I get 720,400,000 something, 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 okay? I don't have a braille display here and it's a pain. So we now, everybody cool with that step? That's how big our file is in bytes. We now multiply that by 8 to get it into bits. Now if you're using BC, you can go last star 8, but you're probably not using BC, but I just thought I'd mention that anyway. So I get something in the range of 5,700,000,000 and yeah. So that's the number of bits in the file. Everybody cool with that so far?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, how fast a link are we downloading Paris Hilton on? I reckon we're downloading her on a 2 megabit link. So we are going to divide that big number by 2 million. 2,885.6 seconds. Divide by 60 to get approximate minutes. So it's going to take about 48 minutes to download that video.
Yeah. Go have lunch.
Yeah. Yes, John.
So when you're calculating this, the file sizes are in, you said, mentioned 2 to the power of 20 for the number of megabytes they are, but the actual speed of the transfer, that's measured in just using powers of 10?
That is correct. Just to confuse you, yeah. So if you're actually doing this on a computer and you're actually looking at a file size, take the whole file size in bytes that shows up in the properties window, not the number of megabytes. Now, I heard somewhere that Apple had defined the megabytes as millions under their operating system. Is that right? There's something for people to look into. Apparently, under Snow Leopard and stuff, the millions on the Mac are actually, the megabytes are actually millions. They've sort of steered away from everybody else and said this is in millions, not the two to the whatever megs.
I believe that is true. They did change that.
Okay. That's just like what? It's just confusing people.
It does suit their attitude towards things, doesn't it?
Well, we could get into a discussion on that. Let's not. I am sad enough to have jailbroken my iPod so that I could use GPS devices on it. So what does that say about me?
Uh-huh. It's all Unix underneath. That's all you're supposed to know. Smile and walk away.
Aha, uh-huh. But I'm going to SSH in and mess around. Okay. all right, so what I want to do is talk about... Okay, so is there anything specifically that people want me to talk about in the last 20 minutes or so? Does anybody need a loo break for a few minutes? Does anybody want to do that?
Hey, just a quick one would be...
All right, I'll be back in about 4 minutes. And I will be back in 4 minutes, and we will be doing another little bit more lecture. So please come back, everybody.
Should
see you
time
in
me?
A few minutes. You can if you like. If you've got that much free time, knock yourself out.
So this show he was talking about is called The IT Crowd?
Yep.
It's a British show?
I'm not sure if it's British. That would be my guess, but I'm not positive.
Huh. I may have to go hunting around for it. Yeah, Maya, at some point we could chat about the mail list stuff, because I know some of the stuff he wants me to do, but I don't know... Yeah, be good to get some input. He wants me to implement so you can actually search the archives, which is good.
What a novel idea.
Well, I'm just amazed that Mailman just doesn't do it. I'm amazed that they didn't build that in.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's going to pay me, so, you know, it's good.
Hey, that's not...
Well, I'm not going to do this for free, man.
You mean they sometimes don't expect you to do something out of the goodness of your heart? Sorry, that was a cheap shot.
No, you're fine. Corey, are you still on here?
Yeah.
How the heck did you work for Comcast, man? You're in Canada.
Yes. Think on that for a moment and see what you come up with.
All right.
In Canada.
Does it kind of give you kind of a hint? I'm not sure if this is recording, but...
Well, we edit the recordings.
Okay. I worked for a company who does outsourcing call center work for Comcast, or did anyway. Might still, might not, I'm not sure. But, yeah, I could tell you lots of stuff about that, at least... Might have changed somewhat since I was there, but a lot of the stuff is still the same.
Cool.
Yeah, it was an interesting job, for sure.
And where are you again? Is it Alberta?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What, Edmonton, or where are you?
Lethbridge.
Okay.
My last trip to Edmonton, I set up home base at Tim Hortons. It was great.
I have a Tim Hortons, like, literally around the block from my house. It's a beautiful thing.
It's a dangerous thing.
Boston cream is amazing.
What's that, Barry?
That's
I was saying that the Boston Creams, I'm very sad.
Barry, when have you had Tim Hortons?
Oh, I've been to Canada about 10 times, man.
Cool. What were you saying, Maya?
I'm very sad. I'm moving even farther away from any coffee sources that, with the new apartment. The new apartment's not a lot nicer, but moving farther away from convenient things like coffee.
Whereabouts are you again, Jason? In Canada?
Toronto.
Oh, I was there 2 years ago. A friend of mine lives in Toronto, actually.
Oh, yeah? Cool. Hey, I've actually been here.
I will. Okay, I'm back. And yes, I was longer than 4 minutes because my boss decided he wanted to talk to me.
Yeah, I really shouldn't ignore that.
Yeah, you're probably right. Okay, is everybody else back?
Yep.
I think we're all here.
Yep. I think so.
Okie dokie. Now, so we worked out that thing with the file size, and that was all good, and we worked out that we have to convert the file size into bits, and then we divide the file size by the link speed in bits. Now, this is all approximate. There is actually protocol overhead that goes into play, because it's not just the file data that goes across the link. There are the packet headers and trailers and stuff that we start talking about in Module 4, which we don't get to this week, I don't think, because I want to talk about some general concepts and things. Well, I'll talk about bits of Module 4, but we're not going to sort of heavily get into it. So, you guys have got... We're not going to count this as a week for Module 4, so you don't have to have Module 4 labs until the week after next. Okay, so everybody understand that?
Yeah.
Yep.
Carrie, I have a question about the exams. Can we ask that now or wait?
No, you can ask that now if you want.
So you said you sent out that email saying that they are available for a week. Do you have to enable certain ones, or can we do whichever one?
If you would like to sit Module 11 today, you can. We certainly recommend that you don't. When I activate all the exams, I do a batch activation, which activates all of the Modules 2 through 11 exam, and it keeps them active up on the site for a week. And then when they become inactive again, I either have to remember to activate them, or somebody has to email me and go, "Oi, the exams aren't active," and I go, and then I go in and activate them again. Now, with the exams, and I think I did cover this before, you need to get the diagram descriptions off QCAT.org, and you need to have those open in a window or something while you're taking the exam.
Which one should we be conceivably having done at this point? 2 and 3?
Probably only 2 and 3, yeah. I mean, if you think you know more, you can go and try 4, 5, whatever, if you want. But to be honest, if you take too many attempts in an exam and you continue to get it wrong, I really want to talk to you and go through what you got wrong to help you understand. Otherwise, you're wasting your time doing that. So if you take the exam twice and you're still not doing too good, it might be worth setting up an appointment with me to get on Skype and talk to you. Now, I am rarely on my work Skype. I'm on my work Skype when I'm at work. You will need to email me and make an appointment for me to turn up on my work Skype, and I can do that at home. I just don't tend to. So, for example, from about 8 in the morning Universal right through to about 2 in the afternoon Universal, for example, I can make myself available. And I can make myself available on days of the week that aren't teaching days. But you have to email me and set up a time, because otherwise I won't. Because, you know, there are fun things to do. Usually sitting around on some Team Talk server talking to people and whiling the day away. So do sort of take advantage of that if you think you need extra tuition, or you need to talk to me about something, or you want to ask me questions or whatever. I'm not against Skype at all, but there was a time in 2007 where all of the Indian students used to call me up at 10 o'clock at night, which was just sort of their afternoon, evening sort of thing, and I was not as awake as I should have been to answer those questions, and it was somewhat unpleasant. Just out of curiosity, is everybody reading the curriculum from www.qcat.org, or are you guys pulling it off the NEDACAD site?
I'm doing QCAT.org for
the other one, but I could use
QCAT.
Okay. Look, it doesn't make any difference which one you pull it from. I was just curious. Now, we all do know about QCAT.org because I seriously ran a class for 10 weeks, and we got to week 10 and the people in the class said, "Sir, these lectures are really very good, but are there any notes?" And Geraldine and I just about went outside and screamed because we had mentioned QCAT.org for the last 10 weeks, but I don't know why this... And there were about five of the people in the class that went, "Oh, QCAT.org, we've never been there." Okay, so if you haven't been to QCAT.org by now, please go there.
You have to drill down quite a ways on NEDACAD to get to the curriculum. It's quite aggravating, so I try to not go there.
Yeah, I agree.
Could they make it any more cumbersome? I mean, I don't understand the unnecessary layers that they have there to get to something as practical as the curriculum for your class.
I suppose they want to make sure that you're logged in. So you've got to log in and go through that song and dance first and found the graphical link and then go down to the, you know, the log into the Network Academy, which is a pain. And then you end up on the page that says Do Not Bookmark. And then you log in there and then you pick your class from the table because you might be in more than one class. And then I think you can view curriculum from there. But it is a pain. I would recommend QCAT.org. I really would. But whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if there's a difference, but yeah, I can use that. Kara, I don't know if this is an appropriate question for you or for Grace more, but I see it is the 30th already, believe it or not, and I do owe you guys some cash hola, so I was going to pay that, but is there any specific things I need to do to make sure it's properly received and recorded?
Ah, now funnily you should mention that, because it is almost pay time. Now, what basically happens when it's almost pay time is we start haranguing you all down and see who's paid. Some of you have already paid and it's a moot point. If you don't pay in another month, we really start having talks with you about whether you're going to continue on with the Academy and whether your account is going to exist in NETACAD for much longer. So that's how it works. So if for some reason then you have a really good reason why you can't pay, you need to tell us and we will make arrangements. But if you don't talk to us and another month goes by, we will start trying to get a hold of you and then take you out of the Academy. So that's how it works. I know it's horrible, but that's who we are. what you do is you go to www.qcat.org and you click the donate to QCAT/pay course fees. And that will take you through to PayPal. And may I request that everybody please put their name and the course that they are paying for so that when it shows up on the PayPal, we can see that you have paid for particular courses.
Right, so I've got like payment for Corey Martin for Exploration 1 in the comments field. And then, yeah. The reason I ask is because the PayPal address, email address I have on file with PayPal is not the usual one that I normally use. I have like 5 email addresses, so...
No. That's why you've got to put your name in the comments and what course you're paying for, so that when it turns up in our little spreadsheet that shows who's paid and who hasn't paid, we can see that you paid. Like, if you're on a payment plan and you're paying $50 a month, you do the payment plan thing. And if you're paying the full amount, you say that you're paying the full amount, and it's all good. Any questions on how to pay your course fees?
Just want to double check what they are. Isn't it 150?
It is 150 per course. If you fail a course and come back for a second semester, it is only 75 to take the next semester, like another the course over again. I hope none of you end up like that, but that's how much it is.
Okay. So 150 like US, Canadian, when 150 what?
US. We always take it in US dollars, even if their dollar isn't particularly great.
Okay.
Now, we haven't figured out how you can pay the Academy with Bitcoin yet. No, we're not really going to do that. But it was something I was thinking about last night and decided we weren't going to do that. So, yeah. And look, you don't have to pay it for a couple of weeks. Like, you've got a couple of weeks, because the theory is that SSI comes in on the first of the month, and the people who are paying from SSI, we give them a week or two to sort stuff out. But obviously, we would like to see the course fees paid at some point. $150 per course. If you feel you are not taking the course at this point, and you've had enough of my lectures and binary and all that stuff, can you just tell us and we'll let you go without any hard feelings and you don't pay anything? This is your 1 month trial.
Well, I am paid.
Ah, excellent.
Those course fees will buy new PCI serial cards, right?
That's exactly what they're going to buy. And that's exactly what we're going to be putting them towards, because we'd like that remote bundle to become a little bit more stable.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. It seemed to be kind of buggy. Is it going to take a while to get it going again?
probably 15 or 20 minutes to get the other workstations back up. I need to plug the workstations back into the wall and try and find out what's going on with them. It's all right. We've got the patch gear in there to do that. so we will fix that. The problem is that when the power comes back to the workstations and stuff, the USB to serials don't come up reliably. So if one of the ports doesn't come back up, you end up with a situation where you can only see one of the workstations out of the pod.
Ah, thus PCI to serial works better. Yes.
That is correct. Okay. Any other questions and stuff that people want covered? Has everybody got the password for the virtual machines area? VMware and machines with a capital M, in case you want to play with Linux virtual machines?
Yeah. And that's where the instructions for them are? I didn't see that in the labs area.
Yes, it is. The instructions are hidden inside the virtual machines area, because it is figured that you will not need the instructions unless you are using the virtual machines.
Yes, okay.
And the instructions are quite good. They're not overly verbose and tell you what you need to know. They're good.
Yeah, if anybody has any suggestions on any of our resources, we'd be more than happy to take them on board. And in fact, if you rewrite the documentation, we'll even put it up. But I mean, if you suggest things that you need to change or that things are too verbose or whatever. Has anybody seen the time zone thing on the student resources page? Thank you, Mr. Nestrid. Has anybody seen it? It's kind of cool.
No, not yet.
Ah, well, if you look on student resources page, it says student resources, and then it says the time in Perth is currently blah. Click here to see what time it is in other time zones. So when you get bored, that's something to have a look at. We nicked it off the zone, and it's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, I see. Very nice. Carrie, did you say there was some rudimentary documentation about the remote bundle, or did you say that that was a work in progress?
There is some rudimentary documentation about the remote bundle, and I could stack that up somewhere. I think there's some under networking. Just let me have a look, because I've got Samba into this thing, so I get to browse this faster than you guys. Cavi data, web server, QCAT, class notes, general instruction. Ah, there is a description of the remote bundle in the networking folder. Has everybody seen that one? I'm not saying that it's much good.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Okay, there's two more documents that are in the in my Dropbox that I'll put up onto the server that are in various states of work. I'm seriously looking at getting this wiki up and running, and I think I'm going to feed some of this documentation into the wiki, because that way people can add things that they find are important. Please, if we can avoid things like... And if you've enjoyed reading this wiki article, perhaps you would enjoy buying an insert product vendor's product name. So obviously be a bit sensible with the wiki, but we will have the ability for you all to add things in that are important and impressive and stuff, so that you guys can help everybody else out. But I certainly will put the documentation up I have in the state that it's in, and I will be working on fleshing that out more to make it make a lot more sense. I think eventually what's going to happen is that the remote bundle is complicated enough to actually turn it into a number of sub-HTML pages, because I'm finding that one big document for the remote bundle's got a whole lot of how to use Linux and this and that and the other, and I'd sort of like to split things off into the power switch, the Linux and the other things, so that you could drill down into the section that you actually wanted.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go, and as I get more experience and more comfortable, I'll be happy to volunteer to help with documenting some of that if I'm able to assist.
Absolutely. And a reminder with the virtual machines under Linux, if you're playing with them, if you want them to turn up on your own network, change it from NAT to bridged. You may have to edit the VMX, or if you've got some sort of VMware product where you don't have to do that, well and good. I think you can change it in Player, actually. I think you can actually change that in Player. There are some JAWS scripts for Player that make the menus read correctly. I have no idea for WindowEyes. I will try and stick those JAWS scripts up on the website so that you guys can get them. And don't forget to go to the IP address of the virtual machine /delta-whiskey-whiskey-whiskey, or DWWW, and you can get access to all of the man pages onto the Linux machine, and in fact, if you app-get install new packages onto the Linux machine, the man pages will automatically show up in that DWWW section. So, I reckon that's kind of schmick. Okay, anything else before I hit stop on the record? I was going to go into transport layer stuff, but I'm going to save that till next week. I am also, and I've been saying this for a while, but I am actually going to try podcast feeds. So when I get those working, I will notify people. And if you're brave enough, you can try it. And if it blows up your podcaster, I apologize in advance. But we are going to try that.
Oh, no, that would be brilliant to have the lectures on a XML feed, so they would come to us. That'd be slick.
We're going to try it. There's a thing called Durcaster that might let me do it. So we'll certainly play with that. And anybody who's got pod stuff can pull those down. Okay. So anything else before I hit the stop button? Because we can still talk after I hit the stop button. But anything that anybody feels needs to be on recording or asked or whatever.